This is Joshua Parthe and Primrose Zenga interviewing Dr. Jacqueline Scott on December the 3rd at 10:33 a.m. in the Sage North Hall. This interview is part of the Barrett Oral History Project. Our goal is to preserve a record of Barrett's history in honor of our 30th anniversary. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and share your experience.
It's my pleasure.
So, what led you to apply to be a faculty member here at Barrett?
The interdisciplinarity of the teaching opportunities here at Barrett is really exactly what I wanted. I think I became a professor because I love learning, and any job, I was trained as a business manager and worked in business for 7 years, more than 7 years before I came here, but I would find in the past that any job, I would sort of get it after 6 months, and then I was eager to learn more, and this job, teaching the human event and all the other teaching opportunities here, you never are there. There's always more to learn. And other opportunities, when I came here, I had tenure-track job offers from universities around the country. But those jobs tend to be more singular pathed. You have to stay in your area of research, which for me was English literature. Whereas being a Barrett faculty member, it's like being able to declare like 10 majors at the same time, and you can just focus in different areas. So I knew this was my dream job. Before I even applied, I was working to get the experience to be able to apply for it. So that's why, basically, the opportunities.
Okay. So how long have you been a faculty member here?
Since the olden ages. So I actually came to Arizona State in 1992, and I joined Barrett as a faculty member in 2001. And so this is my 18th year teaching at Barrett. But to put that in perspective, when I came to ASU, the Tempe campus was called ASU Main. ASU West was just getting started. ASU Polytechnic was called the East Campus, ASU East, because everything was like relational to Maine, and now we don't do that anymore. And downtown had not even been conceived of yet. And so it was a very, very different landscape there. And when I came to Barrett in 2001, it was the ASU was a bit more developed, but just to put it into perspective, we have 40 honors faculty fellows now. Then we had, I was the eighth person to be hired, and we were not on this beautiful campus that we're on now. We were over in Irish Hall, which were buildings like built in the 60s and maintained in that same way. So I've been here a very long time and seen many changes.
You mentioned that coming to Barrett was almost a dream come true. So how did you get to know about the Honors College?
Well, I worked, when I knew about Barrett from working with Barrett faculty in my previous role. I was the business manager in ASU's English department. And then I became a program manager this is where I really knew about Barrett. I was the program manager of the Interdisciplinary Humanities program that existed at that time. So it was like similar to a Barrett. Interdisciplinary humanities students were getting their degrees in a whole combination of subjects and putting those together. And the teaching was similar, except, so have you taken human event?
Yes.
Yes. And so, and have you had human event or history of ideas?
I have had history of ideas.
Yes, exactly. So those are seminars. You have small class sizes, capped now at 21. Back, the interdisciplinary humanities program taught similar type classes, but to like 300 students at a time. So it would be lecture, lecture, wow. Lecture, and then we'd have small breakout groups. So I was working in that field, and then began working as a teaching associate when I was getting my PhD. And so that's how I knew about it. It became my dream job because I love teaching the material, but I love teaching seminars where everybody's active, and sometimes in those lecture classes.
Yeah.
You try, but they can tune out a bit.
So you played a major role in the designing of the Barrett campus here at Tempe, including proposing the amphitheater just outside. So what were your goals for Barrett students' academic and social life here when designing this complex?
That was the best committee I've ever been on, let me just say, because we got to dream about, it was a four-year-long planning committee, and we got to dream about ideal, for me it was teaching and mentoring spaces I was really looking at. And then the architects, they didn't agree with everything I said, but they really listened. And so that was wonderful. And so my goals were really to create space that would allow for collaboration. Because what I find distinctive, really distinctive about Barrett, ASU in general and Barrett in particular, is that we are high-achieving people, but we're not cutthroat. Maybe towards U of A, but not with each other. Like, the students I work with are just so beautifully collaborative and supportive, but you need space to enable that. And so a priority for me was to take advantage of our wonderful fall and winter weather and have outdoor teaching spaces. So I'm quite proud of that. Like, the fireplace and the different places where sometimes you'll see outdoor classes in the amphitheater, those were ideas I proposed. Oh. And also the amphitheater itself was, because we do study abroads, a lot of study abroad programs to Greece and Italy, which I have been involved in, I thought, how cool if we could have a little performance space. It was based on Epidaurus in the Peloponnese in Greece, which is actually much bigger than the amphitheater we got, but I was happy with it. Just to reiterate, the space is, it enables the kind of innovative exchange of ideas and collaboration, and we that we're known for at ASU and at Barrett, and we wanted to make it so the classrooms were spaced out. They weren't in one building where maybe the faculty would only be seen in one place on campus. Instead, the classrooms are all over the campus. We go to the dining hall it really feels like a living and learning community. You see the people you know when you're living here, or even if you're just visiting, all over, not just in one little centralized place.
Okay. So as a Dean's Fellow at Barrett, how do you see your current role in its community?
I'm very fortunate to be a Dean's Fellow for National Scholarship Advisement, which means that 40% of my appointment is advising students on nationally competed scholarships, such as Fulbright's and Gates Cambridge, and, you know, the ones that are really hard to get, but our students do really well in that. So in one sense, as a Dean's Fellow, I'm a liaison between the rest of the Barrett faculty and other faculty also outside of Barrett who are mentoring high-achieving students and trying to help them do the best job that they can do in supporting our students. An example of that would be that Dean Kyle Mox and I frequently do workshops for faculty who are writing letters of recommendation for students with, you know, tips on how to write the most powerful letters of recommendation and how to best mentor students, because everyone at ASU who's a faculty member wants to support their students, but they don't necessarily come in knowing, having the kind of experience that Dean Mox and I do. But basically, it's really, because I am a teacher in my core, even more than helping students get the scholarships, what's even more important is that they learn the application tips so that they can go on to apply them throughout their lives. And those tips are things, so I don't know if you see all those thank you notes. A lot of those are from students who will say to me, thank you, this scholarship has changed my life. But there are many of them from students who said, even though I didn't get the scholarship and wish I had, I really appreciate these application tips that I know I'll be able to apply. And one student was like, I didn't get this one, but I got the next three things that I applied for. So, you know, Barrett students apply for a lot of things. And these are, it's a wonderful thing that ASU can do to provide for their students. I've had students, because that is not just Barrett students, it's ASU students too that we support. And I have had, not ASU students too, but we serve the whole population. But I've had students say, I can't believe that a state university is offering me this level of support on scholarship application. So it makes you feel good.
I was wondering, just because this is something that you obviously love, mm-hmm. What are some of the most prestigious scholarships that you've had, like you've advised students and they've gone on to get?
The most prestigious are that I have helped students with Marshalls, for example, which is one of the most, and Gates Cambridge, which is one that I work on a lot. Gates Cambridge is one to Cambridge University, created by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but they are absolutely focused on students, not just who are excellent and who would get into Cambridge anyway, but who are committed to improving the lives of others, which is, you know, a scholarship is an investment in people's education with the hopes that they will make society better. So that one makes a lot of sense. So I've helped students with that one. But the one that I really love, really, really love, is the Fulbright. Both first and second, for there are three in particular that I advise on. One is for Fulbright English Teaching Assistantships. That's a graduate that one applies for starting your junior year and in the fall of your senior year, and then you go for a year to teach somewhere abroad. And that one has a tremendous amount of impact, so I love that. But one that's, and then the Killam is to study in Canada. It's a study abroad, but it's also through Fulbright. But the one that I probably am proudest of is the one for first and second year undergraduates, and that's the Fulbright UK Summer Institute scholarships. So that one, we have been, once when I started as a Dean's Fellow, that was my first assignment, and we've been really successful on many different levels. So there are 60 of these scholarships awarded per year across the whole nation, and they're to study at one of 9 summer institutes in the UK, which would include Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and places in England. And it's a full ride scholarship for 3 to 4 weeks for the student. And they prefer to give them to students who have had little opportunity to travel outside the U.S., so it's really a game changer for them. So we're proud of those because, this is a story, we couldn't believe it. So that we had one person who had secured it before I started advising. And the year I started advising, to our surprise, we got 4 students get them. 2 students to the same institute, which we didn't think would even be possible, since there's only 3 to 10 people from across the nation who get the awards for a particular institute. So I thought, well, this is great. It'll never happen again. The next year we got 5. And I thought, oh, I can't even believe this. But, you know, that's that. In 2016, we had 6 students get this. And what that means, so that was 10%. Of all of the people who got it came from ASU. But then what's beautiful about that one is because it's only for first and second year undergraduates, the students come back, and as opposed to the graduate ones, then they're off doing their alumni thing, but they come back, and then they were so happy to be mentored that they are very generous in mentoring other students, and other students hear about it. And that is what I was saying that I love about Barrett students, is that they're collaborative. Students who are applying, like with the other students, would come back from these experiences, and they would write me these emails when they got back. And so many of them, when you, like, I would open it, the email would say, "Dr. Scott!" Exclamation! 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 It's just really funny. They're like so excited, and one student was like, "It was like a fairy tale. I just can't even believe it." And so then they come and they want to support other students who are applying for these scholarships, and so they have very generously would volunteer their time at information sessions, and I would have group workshops where those students would come in. One year I had a write-in where at one point we had like 14 students who had returned from these who were still on campus who came in to help students like polish up their essays and such. It's just, that is the kind of learning community that I want to be involved in. I'm very proud of these students. And so when I leave here, I'm going to go do a workshop for this particular scholarship, the Fulbright UK Summer Institute. So it's a good one. And it gets students from their first year knowing how to apply, realizing that, like last year, we had 3 students get it. But we had 28 students who were named semifinalists. So they know, even if they didn't get it, they know that they are contenders. And that's just, that's phenomenal, you know? And so the confidence that they will gain in applying for other things, it'll just grow and grow. So I'll be quiet, but I love that one. I'm not supposed to be quiet, but...
No, we love it. Yeah.
So you mentioned you were the founder of the Barrett Faculty Training Program. So could you expand on the reasoning behind its development and the value of this training for the faculty?
So this one, the name of the program is actually the Barrett Faculty Mentoring Program for Teaching Excellence. And I started that in 2005. And so I mentioned I started at Barrett in 2001. And when I came to Barrett, what I saw, I saw a lot of opportunity. Let's put that opportunity for growth. So when I came, there were 8 faculty, and they were, every single faculty member was devoted to student success. They were very committed to their students, but it was so new then that they weren't necessarily collaborating amongst each other. It was almost actually a little more territorial sometimes. And so the thing about Human Event and History of Ideas is it takes a special person to teach that class. You have to be, you know, it's very challenging because we all have our degrees in different areas of disciplinary expertise. And so an astrophysicist, like my wonderful colleague, Dr. Joseph Foy, you know, is teaching Confucius. and you know, everybody has that. It really stretches us as instructors, which is one reason that I love it. But I think it's really important for faculty to support each other. So I created it originally for anyone, not just Barrett Honors Faculty Fellows, but any faculty across the university who was new to teaching honors courses so that they could get support. Because what happens sometimes in teaching, especially at a research university, is sometimes people, new faculty, they don't want to ask for help because it might look like weakness. And every faculty member at Barrett is hired already based on being teaching experts. So it could be that you don't want to have to ask. I wanted to make it so they wouldn't have to ask. They would automatically be supported. And so we created, what that program is in the first 2 years for honors faculty fellows, they have assigned senior faculty mentors and they go visit human event classes and see how, because we don't all teach them the same. So they get to see that there's a wide range of ways of eliciting classroom discussion and things like that. So they get to see a bunch of people and then their classes get visited and they get feedback on their teaching. And then we do workshops on pedagogy because we all love talking about teaching. We love it. And so it gives us even, it almost got too successful because the workshops would be open to, like, the junior faculty had to go and everybody else could go. And when early on in the program, everybody was going, and then the junior faculty had no time to talk about their own challenges. So we've adapted it over the years, you know, based on how many new faculty that we had and such. But the basic program is giving people, making sure that people have the resources they need to be successful.
And if I may ask, why is the Human Event? Why do you think this is such an important course?
I'll limit my answer to 8 reasons. And the first one is that it's a critical thinking and writing and speaking class. And by critical thinking, we mean just generally examining evidence from multiple perspectives. And part of that is questioning assumptions. And so both for people who are students and people in disciplines and in their professions, but especially as citizens, you want critical thinkers who don't just automatically go with the way things have been. So in my human event class, I just taught the last class and students listened to a keynote, a commencement address by David Foster Wallace called This Is Water, where he was talking about critical thinking and the value of a liberal arts education really is about making sure people know that they have a choice in how they think and that and to pause and not just let your decisions be based on a default setting, but to really question assumptions. And to do that, you can't do that on your own. You need the help of people who are coming from a diverse array of perspectives so that you really can know that you're making the best decision for yourself. So my boss, Dean Mark Jacobs, I think he probably still does. He talks about the human event as great ideas humans have had throughout history. But I also like to teach really bad ideas that humans have had. And that other, there's no shame in having a bad idea. But what's bad is if people don't speak up and say, let's think about this from a few other perspectives. They need to be confident enough to speak up when decisions are being made, and decision makers have to listen. And that's another value of human event, is that practicing critical discussion in sort of that 18 to 21 person seminar format where everyone is speaking and sharing their ideas. Because it does, if you don't practice that early on, they're going to get in their professions and people are going to try to make terrible decisions. They have to feel that they can speak out. That's just two of the reasons. I have so many reasons about human event. The writing is huge. We wish, ultimately, I think, that every student at ASU could have the human event. But it takes a lot of instructor energy to give the customized writing feedback and speaking feedback. So I think I'll just end with that question with saying, faculty across the university say to me all the time that they love having Barrett students in their classes because they raise the bar for other students. Because we get students their first semester at ASU and teach them the joy of learning in a community, which is like not just that passive, I'm going to do what I need to do for the grade, but really being challenged to have done your homework, which is sometimes epically long, as you know, and to contribute your ideas. And so they go out and they share that love of learning in their classes, at least so my colleagues across the university tell me. So I think it's really important in helping people learn how to learn.
You mentioned that each professor can customize their human event classes. So how have you been able to apply your experience and education to your sections?
As I mentioned, I'm sort of always learning, but that doesn't mean that I read in every field. So what's very cool about, so I don't just teach human event. So I also teach study abroad classes and teach special, when I'm not a Dean's Fellow, I teach special topics courses here, and I've been able to do that. So there are a lot on my CV, from all over the place. And so my expertise in literature, because my PhD is in Irish and African American modern literature, I've been able to bring into, of course, my human event classes, but then I have developed classes such as special topics classes that are upper division, such as race, writing, and difference, inventing Ireland. So they're about culture and identity, through written expression, basically. But then, because so much of my career is devoted to teaching, I was able to create a special topics course on teaching excellence, which was for students who are not education majors, but who think they might want to teach at some point. And that was a fun class because you can bring in people from all over the university to share their ideas. But one thing that I've moved very much in the direction of creative nonfiction, for a class called Writing About Self and Place, which I teach on study abroads, but I also teach it at ASU. And so it's sort of like travel writing, but not like Rick Steves' Guide to Paris. It's stories that students have. You can actually see, if you look around you back there, do you see the Discovery Greece Italy Self book on the shelf right back there? And you see books that students have made, like, from their travel writing experience, and they're basically their storytelling. And so I'll be reading creative nonfiction, and then I'll think, well, when I taught downtown on the downtown campus from 2014 to 2017, and there was a new sports journalism major, and I was creative nonfiction would also be nonfiction books about sports, and I'm like, I'm going to create a class for them because it was a new major and they needed more classes, and so that works. And then in doing my research for that class, I'm like, The Blind Side by Michael Lewis would work very well in my human event class. So that came into there. So it all feeds into each other. But I'll just tell you, Joshua, that one of the best things is not just putting my own disciplinary expertise into my classes, but learning from my colleagues. So that mentoring program that I was talking about means that I have visited classes from people who have degrees in the natural sciences, social sciences, humanities, fine arts, all different things. And we learn from each other through visiting each other's classes. So I have what I think is a really fun class on Darwin, Charles Darwin, in my human event class. But I learned a lot of the strategies for teaching that class by visiting one of my colleagues' classes. And so a lot of the things that are actually on my syllabus were because I heard one of my colleagues were doing it, I visited the class, and then I did the research to bring it into my own class. And that is a joy of teaching at Barrett, is that the people who I talk with every day are not in my same field. They're in different fields, so I'm constantly learning and being able to bring that into my classroom. Eventually, it becomes an expertise. In the beginning, I just say, let's try this.
So you mentioned that writing and learning how to express your ideas through written language is one of the main parts of the human event, and you were also involved in the founding of the Barrett Writing Center, which is one of the most popular and impactful resources available for students in the human event and other classes here. So how do you develop new ideas like this to enhance the Barrett experience?
So thank you for saying that it's impactful. I'm glad to know that. So the thing that I just look around and sort of say, what if we ... And then always things are like, let's create a pilot program. Then it's not too much pressure. You know you're going to evaluate it at the end of the year. The way that the Barrett Writing Center came about was from when I joined the Barrett faculty in 2001. So I'm the most junior person. I didn't have as much to do as the other people because I was brand new. And a number of the faculty were saying they really wish, we have a challenging curriculum, as you know. We're trying to cover human thought and expression from antiquity to modern times to 2000 now. And but still really challenge the way students think about writing. And just if I'll digress for a moment to say the reason is when students come in, they've been trained to teach a certain way or to write a certain way. And that writing, that training was to prepare them to get here. So it was to write really good 5-paragraph essays on their SAT written component or what, you know, it's like the timed writing. But that is not the kind of writing most people do in their disciplines. And so we changed the rules and really up the bar, and then that's very challenging for students. So we wanted more of a resource. Also, the faculty are very available, like, so we try to train students on writing in class to the degree we can, be available for office hours. But you probably know, students aren't writing their essays when faculty are available between 8 and 5 p.m. They're writing on weekends, they're writing at night, and you don't want to talk to your faculty member at midnight. So there was a grant opportunity by the Arizona Board of Regents for learner-centered education. And so I was able to write a proposal, not even really expect. I thought, let's just try this. And it was one of the three proposals that got funded at ASU to create a writing center based on learner-centered education principles. And so probably that worked. And then we tried it for a year. I had a great team of tutors. They were so wonderful. And they gave me a lot of feedback, and we just kept revising it, and we continue to do that. So I'm happy that it has stayed. And then probably that gave me the confidence to keep trying new things and even like the mentoring program, like what if we did this? And so we're fortunate at ASU to be so focused on innovation. So this is a university that supports that. They don't all. And we're fortunate at Barrett to have the funding to be able to say, let's try a global classroom. And such. So, but basically, I just say, what if?
Let me ask, what year was that when you got the grant?
2002. So that was in the spring of my first year, I got the grant, and then it opened in the fall of 2002. So we are estimating that it has served 12,000 students since then.
So you mentioned that you are a very strong advocate for study abroad experiences, and you've taught abroad as an instructor. So could you share a couple of the most memorable experiences that you had as an instructor on these study abroad programs?
I will try. There's so many. But one that happened recently, so I've taught 11 Barrett Study Abroads to places like London, Dublin, Edinburgh, Paris in the Loire Valley, Greece and Italy, Paris and Berlin. You see, like I focus more on Europe, and most recently to Prague. And so our Barrett, we wanted to make study abroad accessible also for students who didn't either have the time or the resources for a summer study abroad. So we created last year the Global Intensive, and the one to Prague was the first one. And so took 18 students to Prague. And my goals for study abroad and what leads to the most memorable stories are cultural immersion. And so not just a group of Americans hanging out with each other and taking selfies in front of the Acropolis, for example, but really engaging with locals and trying to learn a bit about their lives, really. And so my very favorite one was when we went to Prague. I always do a cooking class. My class writing about self and place is cultural immersion, and then writing about it in those creative nonfiction stories. And so we arranged for a cooking class where we made Czech staples such as strudel, and we made mac and cheese because it wasn't just my students taking the cooking class. They brought in about 10 elementary age students from a shelter for displaced families, and so these kids were excited just to come into central Prague. That was a good excursion for them. And then they met all these Americans and we cooked together. So they helped us prepare as we were learning how to make the Czech food. And then we made mac and cheese for them so that they would know, because people hear about it, but they don't actually know what it is, you know? And so we had one little elementary age student per two of the 18 students who went to Prague, Sun Devils, and they would cook together. And those students didn't speak English, so it was all sign language and such. And that, it was just so beautiful. But while we were waiting for the dessert to cook, we sort of had a sing-off in which they sang for us. The children sang a song from their culture, and then our Barrett Sun Devils responded with a really beautiful version of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. It was like they had beautiful voices, and then the children sang back, and then we sang back, and it was just like one of those beautiful moments. And some of the students were hugging our Barrett students so much before, and one said, "I'm not going to let you go." And it was translated, she said it, and you know, in Czech. So those sort of moments are amazing. For me, food is very important to culture. So again, always, you know, always the cooking, but when you're adding in the students, it's great. Another one I would say, and I pointed you to it before, I'm going to get a book behind you, just a second, is when you can give someone an opportunity to grow, it's amazing. And this portfolio I'm showing you now, we had a student in 2017 who went to Greece and Italy who was legally blind. And she would never have thought that a study abroad was possible for her. And so to be involved in helping to facilitate such a tremendous... She's a philosophy major, so she wanted to go to Greece so bad. And for her to be able to go... I mean badly, for her to be able to experience the Acropolis through touch and sense and such was really amazing for her. And to be able to self-navigate through the little town of, or it's not that town, but the city of Nauplio on the coast in Greece was also amazing. And then when she went to Rome, she said, I love this city with every fiber of my being. It's a wonderful thing. But my experience with that student is memorable because I learned just as much from her. Like, she changed my life too. And it's when you're, you know, as it all comes down to learning, you know, when you're learning and expanding your understanding of the world, that happens all the time on study abroad. And it's really wonderful, I think.
So, so do you agree that study abroad experiences are one of the most valuable things you can do as a Barrett student?
Absolutely, I agree. It was just based on my own experience. I'm from Detroit, and I would just say just about everyone I grew up with is still there. And, I mean, we went to Canada all the time, all of us, because we lived right on the, you know, Canada was right across the bridge. But for me, doing my study abroad in Strasbourg, which was on the border, it is on the border of Germany and France, it was so transformative. I mean, I hear students say that all the time, that every decision you make, it changes you. And sometimes students, before they go, they're like, I'm afraid to change. Why would I want to change? I'm quite happy. It's just because you just don't know yet what you're going to learn and about the opportunities and such. And also, for a lot of students, it's, you know, you learn about the big world and it can help you deal with the stresses of your you know, undergraduate life, which are real, you know, but it gives you a bigger perspective, but also the confidence to know, because travel is challenging. It's not all singing twinkle twinkle little star. Yeah. You know, it can be really challenging, and to know that you can figure things out and be independent, even with a group of people, is singular. It's one of the singular things for students. They come back much more aware of their own capabilities.
So, with Barrett now being the number one honors college in the United States, and with your participation and involvement with pilot programs and the growth of Barrett till now, how do you envision Barrett's future, both academically and physically, such as in campus enhancements and e-buildings?
Mm-hmm. I think physically, well, I know that we have plans for some really exciting new developments, such as the Lewis Academic Center, and we're going to sort of consolidate student services near the Gold Dome, and that makes, you know, a tremendous amount of sense to me. So the area that I'm more involved in now would be the curricular, expanding the curriculum. And so I'm a huge fan of President Michael Crow's design imperatives, the 8 design imperatives, which, do you know what they are?
No.
Okay. I do know what they are, but I love them so much that these are always here. I didn't put them up for you. I keep them like in front of me so I always can think about how my work aligns with the university's mission. So for those of you listening, those design imperatives, and the first 4 we already do really well, I think, at Barrett, which enables student success, fuse intellectual disciplines, leverage our place, and engage globally. We pursue those every minute, all the time. The 4 that I would want us to hope, I think that we'll be thinking more carefully about, and how we can make sure that we're also creating programs for students that do these things, be socially embedded. We have some things, we could have more, I think, because it goes back to what we're talking about, like work that, to have responsible scholar citizens, you want people who are improving the lives of others, who are creating the kind of communities that they want to live in, that they would be proud to live in. And so being socially embedded, you know, comes with that. Conduct use-inspired research. So not just for the theoretical, but how is this ultimately really going to help people or the planet or what have you. And then value entrepreneurship. I love that one. In fact, and it goes back to the idea of like how do you develop new ideas is really thinking about the what if we. And I would love to develop a program that supported entrepreneurial ideas from students, and they don't have to be huge. Like they can be a small, like, you know, what if we had a healthy snack machine? That's a really bad example. I should have thought of it ahead of time. But, you know, it could be something small, but that improves people's daily lives. Or it can, you know, with Barrett students, it could be really big. We have students doing incredible things. And then the last one, of course, all of that leads up to transforming society. And that goes back to the human event. I think that that is the foundation for transforming society.
Those are all the questions that we have for you today. Do you have any more thoughts that you'd like to share, just in general about your experience at Barrett, the study abroad programs, or anything else?
Well, I'll just say no. Feel free to come back for a follow-up if you want to, like, highlight stories, just because I've been here for so long and seen so many differences. But, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind revisiting one or if you have those, like, engagement. How have you seen that working, like, for you? And for Barrett and for ASU, obviously.
Which one? The Engaged Student Success?
Yes.
That one?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I think that we think about all the time. So when you think about student success, you can think about it from so many different perspectives. And I think through your project, you'll find like members in student services completely thinking about the social lives that students need. I don't think about that as much. I'm really focused on curriculum and such. Although as a teacher, of course, I try not to sign homework over big holidays and things like that. But from a point of view of how they're going to be successful in their academic and in their academic careers and in their applying professional careers, which is part of what I do too, some examples would be how in the classes that we have, do we know that students are getting the support that they need to be successful. So the Barrett Writing Center was one example of what I've done. I created a series of modules called the Human Event and History Ideas Learning Project Modules, and that's because we found out that students could understand conceptually a lot of the principles of argumentative writing, such as like a roadmap. They could understand as a concept what that was. But when you go to do that in a challenging human event paper that has, or history of ideas paper that has like nuanced thoughts, that can be really challenging. So I create these kind of modules. There are four of them. One is on textual analysis because that's the key, is like looking for non-obvious underlying implications and such. So there's textual analysis, and then there's topic sentences, which that is not there for the writer. The topic sentences are there for the very busy reader who needs to know ahead of time what claim you're making so that they could evaluate. So that's a module really explaining the what and the why, what not to do, what to do, and such. And then the next one is on introductions, which would be all that forecasting. And then there's academic style, which you can learn a lot of anywhere. But we did that. I made that because Dr. Brune and I were talking about how our students would understand. They would say they understood, and then they would make the same error on the next paper. And so we're like, we need more than just the Writing Center. We need something to illustrate that they can go through on their own. So we created those, and many faculty use them or a version of the modules, and we're constantly adding to it, adding student videos and things, and we're moving it to Google Drive. So that's another kind of thing where you just go, what more do they need? How can I get that for them? And then I don't know if you've had it, but we're doing grading conferences to grade the papers rather than just writing the feedback and giving it back. And that's very stressful for students. That was something that I initiated on the Tempe campus also. And the reason that is, I started it in 2014, and 100% of my students who I polled anonymously every semester have said to keep them. Because even though they're frayed when they first come in and often leave with comments like it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, what it turns your feedback that you get on this essay that is worth so much of your grade and your learning, it turns it into a dialogue. So we can talk together about what's strong and what, like, we grade them at the same time and the student sees what they actually wrote, and then we talk about them, and then we identify three areas for improvement on the next draft. And so again, I know it can be stressful, but on the other hand, students find out faculty aren't like dragons, and I really enjoy it because I like to talk to people. I don't like to spend all my time like looking at a computer screen or what have you. So those are some examples of things that we've tried. I should probably think of the things we've tried that didn't work. Ooh, I have one for you. Do you want to know?
Yes.
Now, you don't want to say didn't work, but it didn't work as we had hoped. We used to have, when I started, human event was 171 and 172. So what's now 272 was 172. And it looked a lot as it looked today. But when Dean Jacobs came to Barrett and talked to a lot of students, we found more and more of our students are in STEM fields, and they were interested in sort of like natural sciences focused human event. So we thought about this a lot. We came up with the idea that 171 would be 171, and then instead of 172, we would have three different tracks. It would be 272, 273, and 274. And 272 would be a humanities-focused human event, second semester human event. 273 was natural sciences-focused, and 274 was social sciences-focused. And they were still really interdisciplinary. The way you would figure out, like, I would still do science in mine, and someone who's a natural scientist would still do poetry, but it was based on the disciplinary PhD of the instructor. That was the idea. We tried that for many years, but it didn't ultimately help. Students got confused. They were expecting that it would be all science or all humanities or whatever. It wasn't really clear. And since we really find that a liberal arts sort of, that's what human event is. It makes you think about, you look at all different kinds of human thought production, from art to music to architecture, philosophy and science and everything else. And so we went back, so we came back to just 272. So I don't think it was a failure. I think it was a successful experiment that we decided was not the way that we should, emerge in the future. So, but that would be a fun follow-up, is like, what have been the epic failures?
I'm sure when you first came to Barrett, were you still Miss Scott? Because now you're Dr. Scott Lynch, and Dr. Lynch is down the hallway.
Okay. So the story there, which is sometimes confusing, is that I was married when I first came to Barrett, and I had changed my name, so I was Dr. Lynch. So, because I don't know if you know Star Trek, but this really was in my mind, is Dr. Scott sounded a lot like Dr. Spock to me, and I didn't like that feeling. So I'm like, I'm going to change my name and go with Dr. Lynch. And my first year teaching, I was Dr. Lynch for the first few years. But back there, then on the old campus, my office was right near my husband's, and who's also on the faculty here as Dr. We even have the same initials, John Lynch, Jackie Lynch. And so too often, students would come into my office and then stop, startled, and say, "You're not Dr. Lynch." And so I just gave up after a while, and I said, "Okay, I'm going to use my maiden name at work to try to clarify it." And so I tend to go by Dr. Scott, but we put Scott Lynch on the signs just so that students who don't know this boring story. We'll be able to find me, and I don't ultimately care which of the last names that students use, but that's the reason why it was just to distinguish myself from a tall, red-haired Irish man that I am not.
Another, she is happy that she had the other one.
Another funny story about that is that, so when my husband and I, before we started Barrett, but at ASU, when we first got married, we lived at what was then called ASU East. It's now the Polytechnic campus, because we were able to rent a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house for $500 a month, which was just about all we had. You know, that's about all that we were making. And so it was new, because it was like transitioning from Williams Gatefield Airport to this campus. So yeah, it was amazing. They had military housing, and so that's what we ultimately moved into. But for, you know, graduate students on a very, very limited budget, it was wonderful. But we would have to drive all the way out there, and there was nothing at the time. It just wasn't developed yet. And so there was one restaurant within, like, miles. And it was very funny because it was Cosmos Restaurant on the corner just outside the campus. And there were a lot of retired people out there. So Cosmos would be very busy between, like, 4 and 6 during the early bird special. And then there would be nobody. Yeah. It was funny, but we were very appreciative to have that opportunity.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Scott Lynch.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
And if we have any other questions, we will definitely follow up with you if you give us the time.
Okay, great.
Yeah, if you have any questions about this interview or the oral project, please contact Dr. or Vice Dean Nicola Foote. And if any more thoughts you'd like to share for this interview, please feel free to reach out, and we can schedule a time that works best, and we can talk more about it.
Okay, great. Thank you. This is really fun.
Nice meeting you.
Thank you as well.